It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Welcome back to our weekly series, The Lines Between Us. After a couple months looking at the relationship between housing, wealth, and inequality, we're turning our attention to equality of economic opportunity. First, small businesses. Through much of the 20th century, commercial credit was hard to come by for people of color. In Baltimore, part of that gap was filled by William Lloyd Adams, known as Little Willie. After making a lot of money running illegal lotteries in the 1940s Baltimore, he turned to more legitimate enterprises and essentially became a bank for aspiring business people who lacked access to credit. When Adams died last year at age 97, former Baltimore Mayor Thomas D'Alessandro III told the Baltimore Sun, quote, "Little Willie brought black entrepreneurs into the formerly all-white business community," close quote. We want to talk about Little Willie Adams today, as well as efforts to expand credit to minority business people throughout the last part of the 20th century. And joining us is University of Maryland Law Professor Larry Gibson. His voice may sound familiar. He's been on WYPR recently talking about his new book, Young Thurgood, The Making of a Supreme Court Justice. He's also played a part in the Little Willie Adams story. Welcome back to the show, Professor Gibson.
My pleasure to be here.
And also with us is Acneil Muldrow II, chair of the Governor's Commission on Small Business. He ran the Development Credit Fund Incorporated, which expanded lending to small minority businesses here in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Mr. Muldrow, welcome to the show.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Larry Gibson, tell us your role in Little Willie's business lending.
I got out of law school in 1967. And went to work for the largest black law firm in Baltimore. George Russell, who had been Mr. Adams's attorney for many years, had just gone on the bench. And so I had the fortune of being a young lawyer who then had an opportunity to handle matters that previously would have been handled by George Russell, some of Mr. Adams's matters relating to loans that Mr. Adams was making to people to assist them either in acquiring a business and expanding a business.
And were these just sort of pretty typical business loans, or was there something different about a loan that Willie Adams made?
Well, what I later learned what was different about them is he generally did not expect to be repaid. Yes. the documents would appear as if there was an expectation of being repaid. But I would later, a year or so later, point out to him that under these records which we've prepared for you, certain person owes you some money and they haven't been paying you, and Mr. Adams would just kind of brush it off.
Well, wait a minute. Explain this to me, because Willie Adams didn't get to be wealthy, and he was wealthy by lending money to people who didn't pay him back.
There's what Mr. Adams did expect is that one to periodically acknowledge that the debt was there. He did not expect you to be forgetful.
Business loans.
The reason this sticks out is I've represented other clients. Most often I'm representing the borrower, and the collection efforts would be rather vigorous. That was often not the case with Mr. Adams, and I don't know if anyone ever really has ever told that story. But this is something that I know firsthand.
Oftentimes with Mr. Adams was relationships. I met him many years ago through Henry Parks. And it's through
the owner of Park Sausage.
Park Sausage Company. And oftentimes it was through relationships, whether he enforced the repayment. But he was making money in many other enterprises that they were involved in, he and other partners. So he perhaps didn't put pressure. But my experience with him in later years when I managed the Development Credit Fund, Mr. Adams brought some people to me and said that, I'd like for you to help this person. This is the son of someone who was a friend of mine, and I'd like for you to help. And if you make the loan to him, I'll guarantee the payment. And that's the way he operated. But I had to do the due diligence in going through and saying, well, Mr. Adams, I'm sorry that this is not a creditable credit, because while you will really pay me if there's a default, I think in all fairness to you, the person should pay the loan back. And he agreed with me in many instances. But He had a lot of enterprises, a lot of real estate. He also had a number of entertainment venues. Mm-hmm. So he was making money. So the loans that Attorney Gibson is talking about, that was probably secondary to what he was making in other activities. Really, I looked at it one day and I said to someone, Mr. Adams had a conglomerate before white America had one, because he had real estate. He had someone handling that. He had commercial transactions. And interesting enough, the person who handled the commercial transactions was primarily a Jewish fellow who could go to the table. He also had other interests. It was almost like divisions. So there were a lot of things that he invested in and had people to manage for him. And he was just, he was really the banker for our community, because the commercial lending institutions would not give us anything above a car loan, nothing on a commercial basis.
I want to understand that better. In the middle of the 20th century, 40s, 50s, 60s, what other financing would have been available to a black person who wanted to start a small business?
None.
Absolutely nothing.
Except the SBA. And the SBA gave you a small loan, one loan, that's it. Even if your company grew and you needed additional resources, growth capital, the SBA limited you to one loan. So Mr. Adams was the viable person. If he liked your business, he would assist you and he would give multiple financings.
The SBA had a fixation at the figure $25,000. Did you notice that? They just had a fixation
that
$25,000 is what they would loan.
One size fitted all.
On WIPR, this is The Lines Between Us on Maryland Morning. I'm speaking with University of Maryland Law Professor Larry Gibson and Neil Muldrow, Chair of the Governor's Commission on Small Business. We're talking about which businesses could and couldn't get credit in recent generations. Neil, I'd like to get a sense of where things went after Little Willie. I mean, credit did eventually start expanding in
minority communities. Happened going back to 1974, there was a study done by Johns Hopkins Metro Center, Jack Fisher. And that study centered around where were black businesses in the scheme of things in the 10 largest cities in America. And Baltimore was at the bottom of the 10. We rank with few businesses, little impact in the marketplace. And this was an issue that was being pushed by Henry Parks, because he saw the future. Baltimore, you're going to have an expanding minority population, black population. Where are we as a part of the economic system? And Henry felt that we were not there, because even though he was successful in what he was doing, and some other few others, many of those all who were doing well were all in some way associated with Mr. Adams. Okay, Charlie Burns with his supermarket and chain of drugstores, and you could just name the Gatewoods and all of them, you could just name. They all had some affiliation with Adams, because expansion and growth capital was not a problem to them. If they needed more, Willie and his friends could arrange it. That study was done, and nothing happened, and it was given to the GBC. Greater Baltimore Committee. And so they said nothing. They weren't going to do anything. So Parks pushed it again. So they convened a committee to study the state of African-American businesses in the city. And around that time, President Reagan came in, and he wanted to abolish the SBA. Well, that was on our only source. Where would we get money? The $25,000, we wouldn't even get that. So under the guide of the GBC and led by Alan Hoblitzel, who was then the chairman of Maryland National Bank, he said, we need to create our own funding source. And he proposed that the six major banks in the state set up a $7.5 million loan fund for the first year, and then the next year we give $7.5 million again, and then the next year $7.5 million, which would have been $21.5 million to fund these not minority loans but economically and socially disadvantaged, which is actually the language of the SBA. So this was launched in February of 1983.
This was the Development Credit Fund.
And
you were its head.
Yes. And I had come out of a lending background with commercial credit company.
And you actually continue to operate until...
We did for 22 years, and every 5 years I'd call him up and say, we made another one. But what we did, we operated as a business, not a social program. We made loans based on structure, and we collected our loans because we had a revolving fund. And we were able to assist businesses, but we were gentle. I told them every time we made a loan, I said, to the borrower, you have the right to quiet enjoyment. And they said, well, what does that mean? I said, you can enjoy the money as long as you pay me. And if you don't pay me, there are circumstances and consequences.
What does that mean, circumstances and consequences?
We're going to exercise the provisions of the documents that we'll foreclose. Just plain and simple. Whereas people say, well, I want to talk to my legislator. Talk to them. It's a wonderful conversation. But the document says you pay me or I liquidate. Because I have to get the money back because I can have to lend it to other people.
And roughly what proportion of the time did you actually go to that extent?
We didn't have a large default ratio because what we tried to do is work with the clients through difficult situations. And our role was really transitioning people to regular commercial banks because of the participants in the Development Credit Fund who set us up, we were trying to get loans of a quality nature to them so that then they could have them as customers, not us.
But tell me when you talk about working with the customers, you have this wonderful program with you that has pictures of some of the people that you lent money to. Pick one of them and tell me.
Well,
tell me how you worked with.
Well, I worked with, this nice lady who had a bakery in East Baltimore. And she came in. She wanted to borrow money, didn't have a lot of collateral. And that's one of the things. We were not like a bank. We looked at collateral, but that was not the primary thing. What is the project you're working on? Do we think that it will be successful? She came in. She made application. And she wanted to borrow, I think it was $25,000 to expand her business. Well, we looked at it, and if you're going to expand in the manner you're talking about, exactly how are you going to deliver the bread to your customers? She said, well, I put them in my car. I think she had a small car, and that's where I've been doing it. But your small car cannot handle it. So what we did in working with her, we said, we need to finance a van for you, something she hadn't thought about.
How many loans did you make?
Over time, we made over 800 and some loans. And we had a default ratio, which was just a little higher than bank. We were about 4%. We were able to do it. We lasted for 22 years. We borrowed the money from the banks, and that was an interesting thing. We borrowed the money from the banks, and we found out later on the day that they made the loans, they wrote the loans off because they figured they wouldn't get money back. We did pay them back.
So you shut down in 2004?
Yes.
Why?
Really 2005.
Why?
We had a structure where we had prime plus. We always had a floating rate. Well, as prime dropped, the spread was not enough to cover our cost. So we needed to raise money. The bankers were not really willing to put up any additional funds because they had gotten into the market. One local bank designed a department identical to ours. They were in the market competing against us because they found out making loans to these small businesses could work. Now, it costs more to do business, so small loans will not make it.
That's Neil Muldrow, chair of the Governor's Commission on Small Business, here on The Lines Between Us on Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Also with us is University of Maryland Law Professor Larry Gibson, and we're talking about credit for African-American entrepreneurs. I want to get back to how you see things now. Development Credit Fund closed in 2004. You told the Baltimore Sun, quote, our market began to narrow because the kind of customers that came to us 20 years ago were basically very strong minority businesses. They basically had no outlet for where they could get loans. Things have changed over the last 21 years, mm-hmm. end quote. The biggest change being?
Being that the major banks began to open up. They began to open up, and those customers who traditionally would have come to us, the stronger ones, they were able to get financing at the commercial bank where they couldn't get it 21 years prior.
And so that left you a market of more
trouble? So we were we had more troubled loans coming to us, more applications we were having to turn down because we didn't feel they had the resources to be successful. So that is where the change came in. The other thing we tried to launch in some way, how do we get equity? Would there be a fund for equity? Some we perhaps could have made loans to, but there needed to be more equity investment in those businesses. And where we felt that the borrower had nothing at risk. No one had anything at risk but us. It's not our business, so we couldn't do that. So that's those are one of the major reasons, because the other banks were really saw that you could make a dollar off of this market. And we had not only African-Americans, we had women, and we also had other ethnic groups.
Professor Gibson, where do you think we are now in this 21st century? Have we reached a point where people of color have an equal opportunity to start and succeed in a business?
We are where we've probably always been, in transition. Things have changed. The whole world has changed. What Neil has pointed out is that many of the things that the market, the opportunity that was there for their organization is not as there because other opportunities have opened. In a sense, the reason that the Development Credit Fund was there was to kind of work itself out of business. Mm-hmm. So there have been changes, there have been improvements, but there's still a long way to go. It takes quite a while to undo the consequences of 200 almost 300 years of slavery.
Along those lines, too, what happened in many instances where the small business had an opportunity to get government contracts, many of your larger firms decided to go into that market. So then there were agencies who said, well, it's easier for us to deal with the larger company because we don't have to have as many people on staff. So they bundled many contracts. So the larger agencies got them. So where that small business person may have been doing business, it was no more. Now we need to get more people interested in entrepreneurship. It has shifted from the gas station or the traditional kind of thing. We're in life sciences. We're in technology. How do we get people interested in that? And I'd just like to mention that I'm working on a project with the Baltimore Times.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about
and,
that.
And Coppin State University's School of Business to try to, through media, promote entrepreneurship in the African-American community or in women's businesses. Being in business is taking a risk. You don't find a lot of people who are willing to take that risk. So we have to show them a way to be self-sustaining, owning an enterprise, and employing people. And that's what we're looking at. How do we get more African-Americans, particularly, in ownership positions? Because they'll hire other people who are African-Americans. It's been proven people will hire their own. How do we get more of that here in Baltimore?
I commented earlier that things were in transition. Let's think of a couple of sort of transitional things that have taken place. There was a time when certain kinds of black businesses were not guaranteed success, but had a pretty good chance of success as a result of discrimination against blacks in terms of being able to use other businesses. I mean, there were black restaurants that succeeded because blacks couldn't go to any other restaurants. So that has changed. There were times when the cream of the crop of the business-minded people was guaranteed to be in black businesses because they could not get employment in any majority-owned businesses. Well, now that's changing. And so as we get rid of some of the past discriminations, it creates a different situation than what had existed under some of the things in the past. So it takes time to figure this out and to make adjustments. I commented recently on I'm going to be at Douglas High School today. We're distributing some of my books. Well, there was a time when Douglas High School's principal was always a PhD. Its vice principal mm-hmm. tended a PhD. But this was a result of discrimination, mm-hmm. is because educated blacks had very few options as to where they could go. Mm-hmm. So some of these problems we're having now are a result of successes. Of right. transitions and things that are taking place that we've wanted to take place. We all hope to be ultimately at a point where there's no need for a development credit fund because an African-American businessman has an equal chance as a white business person to get the funding for their businesses.
I wish we had more time. Thank you for this conversation. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Neil Modreau II is chair of the Governor's Commission on Small Business. Larry Gibson is a law professor at the University of Maryland and the author of Young Thurgood, Making of a Supreme Court Justice. He'll be at Douglas High School this morning to distribute copies of his books to students there. We have more information online at linesbetweenus.org. I'm Sheila Cass. Later on The Lines Between Us, Tom Hall talks to former Baltimore Mayor Kurt Schmoak about the war on drugs. Stay with us here on 88.1.
I'm assistant producer Jamila Kay. You're listening to Maryland Mornings, The Lines Between Us series on WYPR 88.1 in Baltimore. Visit our website, linesbetweenus.org, to hear more stories, to see maps that reveal the lines in your neighborhood, and to participate in the discussion. Thanks for downloading this week's show. Now back to the podcast.
On 88.1 from Falby Hall at the Brown Center on the campus of the Maryland Institute College of Art, I'm Tom Hall, and this is the WIPR Maryland Film Festival Spotlight. Thank you very much. It's Thursday night, December 13th, 2012, and on this edition of the Spotlight and continuing our series, The Lines Between Us, a conversation with the former mayor of Baltimore, Kurt Schmoak. The audience here at the Brown Center has just seen Eugene Jarecki's powerful documentary, The House I Live In, about the so-called war on drugs. In the late 1980s, Kurt Schmoak was the first elected official in a major office in the United States to suggest that we should consider the drug problem a public health issue rather than treat it solely as a criminal issue. That is the subject that The House I Live In takes up. It won the 2012 Grand Jury Prize at the Sundance Film Festival, and it has been hailed as one of the best documentaries of the year by critics around the country. We are delighted to present it tonight to our audience here at MICA and to welcome as our guest on the Spotlight series, the Honorable Kurt Schmoak. So it's interesting, Mr. Mayor, that the last Spotlight program that we did was about a movie called The Interrupters. And there was a man that started a program to have people intervene in gang violence in mm-hmm. Chicago. And the person who did this was not a law enforcement official. He wasn't a political person. He was an epidemiologist right. who treated the gang problem as a public health problem. As I mentioned, back in the 80s, you were the first person of any stature to really say we should be doing that as well. If we approach the problem of drugs and substance abuse and the laws that surround it as a public health issue, what changes fundamentally? What does the world look like under those circumstances?
Well, I think that the film, the police officers in the film point out the fact that we're not going to become a 100% drug-free America. There will always be some people, for a variety of reasons, who use substances. But if we had invested the money differently, if we had really focused on treatment, early intervention, I think we would have had the numbers clearly would have gone down in terms of crime rate. We also would not have had the extra problems that were associated with intravenous drug use and the sharing of dirty needles, and that was the incredible expansion of the AIDS problem because of that. So there are a wide variety of impacts. We clearly would not have had the same sorts of problems in our schools that we had with so many parents being incarcerated and so many young people moving. At one point, I recall when I was a mayor, that a third of our middle school kids transferred during the school year. So that incredible disruption in their lives. So the drug problem really was a cancer that spread throughout the body politic. And I believe that if we had treated it as a health problem rather than a crime problem, we would have probably cured that cancer and reduced it to something that we could have lived with.
So we didn't do that. No. And over the past 40 years, I mean, a lot of people date the beginning of the war on drugs when Richard Nixon coined that phrase in 1972, called it the greatest menace in America. And in 1988, when you suggested that we start thinking about this as a health issue rather than a criminal issue, you actually used the term decriminalization.
Right.
Congressman Rangel from New York, who's just been elected for his 22nd term, called you the most dangerous man in America for suggesting that.
A bit of an exaggeration.
Yeah, maybe, you know.
Right.
And, of course, drug laws have been on the books for almost 100 years.
Right. And you see, though, it's gone up and down in terms of the public interest in the drug problem, but it has continued to have a terrible impact on our society. I mean, Our country, even its foreign policy is implicated. I mean, we've given all this money to the country of Colombia, millions and millions of dollars, and they end up having a war on their people. And what's gone on in Mexico, and particularly that misbegotten Fast and Furious project where we, you know, thinking that in some way this is going to help the war on drugs, we actually give weapons to a community and they end up being used to kill a drug agent. I mean, it's that kind of craziness that goes on. You can see that all this is well-intentioned. People want to try to help the drug problem. But fundamentally, the real core issue is that prohibition did not work in the 1920s to make ours an alcohol-free America. Prohibition is not working now to make ours a drug-free America.
In the 1980s, when you first became associated with this issue, 80% of Americans were against legalizing any drugs at all, including marijuana.
Right.
5 weeks ago, we had an election in which two states did just that. Do you see the pendulum shifting? Do you see the tide turning?
Yeah, I think that the film made the point that it's not the politicians that are going to lead on this. It's the public. And I just see that people over the last few years have made a clear distinction between certain types of drugs and recognizing that it doesn't make sense, for example, to have marijuana in the same classification as heroin. They are distinct. They have distinct impacts on people's lives. And so the public now is saying, let's take a more rational approach to it. But really, it's the public pushing and very few political leaders going out there saying, I'm going to lead the way.
On 88.1 WYPR, I'm Tom Hall. We're here at the Maryland, the WYPR Maryland Film Festival Spotlight Series. Our guest is the Honorable Kurt Schmoke, the former mayor of Baltimore. We're talking about The House I Live In, a wonderful movie by Eugene Jarecki. How would it work? Let me ask you some of the questions that they were asking you back in the 80s and the 90s. You know,
sure.
If drugs were made legal or accessible, do hospitals dispense them? Pharmacies dispense them? What are the mechanics of how you envision it working?
Yeah, I think if you look at just the politics of it right now, I mean, what would be acceptable to our community? I believe the following, that if we expanded drug courts and allowed more of our judges and gave more resources to actually sentence people to sentences that could be expunged, that they would give them more money for treatment. You'd have more people involved in treatment. If you could actually get rid of a criminal conviction after a couple of years, and it's so difficult to do that now. People need a second chance. I remember George Bush, when he was campaigning for office, and they asked him in his election with Al Gore whether he had ever used drugs. And Bush's response was, when I was young and irresponsible, I was young and irresponsible. Well, what happened with George Bush is that, yeah, he was involved with substance abuse, but he got a second chance. Society gave him a second chance. And all that I'm suggesting is that we have to change our laws in such a way that we recognize that some people are going to stumble right at the beginning, but we ought to be able to give them a second chance. And that one way through the drug courts would be a help. Now, you ask on a broader scale, I would first of all say that we should legalize marijuana first. Leave the other drugs for a while, because this thing is going to take a while for the
just
public
as a practical political matter.
I'm just talking politics now. Mm-hmm. How we get from where we are to a better society, and understand that the overwhelming majority of people who are arrested now for drugs are arrested for marijuana. So marijuana, you know, I hear a lot of politicians say, oh, well, we're just talking about heroin and cocaine. No, no. In fact, we're talking about marijuana. If you legalize that, or what I had suggested before, decriminalization, and decriminalization simply was that we would use fines and other non-criminal sanctions. I take away your license to drive, things of that nature. So it's non-criminal sanctions to address the drug problem. I think if we did that, you'd see a lot of people who might make a mistake early but would change their lives later on, and our society would be better off.
You were very brave when you came out and made the statements that you did about addressing this problem way back in 1988. Very few people have picked up the mantle since then, and it's been a long time. Has your thinking about it evolved at all, and do you find that other people in the political realm, they're having their thinking evolve as well?
Well, two things on that. I had high hopes for Senator Webb, who's also in that the film. I thought that it was going to take someone, a United States senator, with a six-year term, to talk about this issue, to try to move the public. Because I knew that somebody running every 2 years, this is so easy to demonize a person. So you ask about my thinking. Yes, first of all, I did have hopes for someone at the Senate level to take up this issue. But the other thing that I learned—
this does have to be approached from the federal
correct,
level.
Correct.
You can't do one thing in one state or one
well,
city.
Well, that's what we're seeing now in California and other places that have done the medical marijuana route. Some of those people are being prosecuted by U.S. attorneys. Unfortunately, with the support of the Obama administration, so you still have a conflict between state law and federal law. So you need some United States senators or somebody at the federal level to take this on. But the other thing that I learned, the most important thing that I learned in this debate, is that language is important. Because, as I said, when I talked about it initially and tried to discuss it as public health as opposed to criminal justice, but I used the term decriminalization without really explaining what I meant by that. So that put me on the defensive. So I spent a fair amount of time on the defensive. What do you mean? You know, are you for drugs? I mean, I remember the day that I said that, and I told you that you know, people said that I was for legalizing drugs. When I got back to my office, my daughter called me from her school, and she was in the basement on the phone, and she said, "Daddy, what did you say?" And I said, "What?" She said, they say you're for drugs and everything." So, you know, Mario Cuomo, Governor Cuomo, once said that, you know, a politician has to distinguish between ideas that sound good and ideas that are good and sound. And so whenever you come out with an idea that challenges the status quo, you better have an answer and an alternative. And that's the thing that I learned most in that 1988 event.
Well, Mr. Mayor, I wish we had more time. We do not, but thank you so much for your time this evening. We really appreciate it. Mayor Kurt Schmoke, everybody.
Thank you very much.
Kurt Schmoke is the former mayor of Baltimore and the former dean of the law school at Howard University. He's currently the vice president and general counsel at Howard University. The House I Live In is currently available on demand. We'll keep you posted if it's scheduled in theaters in this area. We've got links to more information on our website, WYPR.org. Just click on the Maryland Morning link. On 88.1, you've been listening to the WYPR Maryland Film Festival Spotlight. Throughout the year, we bring filmmakers and other experts together to screen and discuss important movies. Our next Spotlight Series event is Wednesday night, January 16th. 16th. We'll be back here at MICA, and we'll talk to filmmakers Sarah Burns and Dave McMahon about their movie, The Central Park Five. For information about that event, again, come to WIPR.org and click on the Maryland Morning link. This edition of The Spotlight is also part of our year-long series, The Lines Between Us, which examines inequality in our region and which you hear every Friday here on Maryland Morning. We've got a dedicated website for the series. Come to linesbetweenus.org and tell us your stories and hear stories from other listeners. Thanks to Kurt Schmoke, thanks to Jed Dietz and the staff of the Maryland Film Festival, thanks to engineer John Lippitz, to producers Stephanie Hughes and Matt Purdy, and thanks to all of the nice folks who joined us here at MICA. From the Brown Center on the campus of MICA in Baltimore, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Lines Between Us, WYPR's year-long exploration of inequality in the Baltimore region. This is Maryland Morning senior producer Lawrence Lanahan. Now, join the conversation at facebook.com/thelinesbetweenus or tell us your story at linesbetweenus.org. The Lines Between Us is made possible by grants from Associated Black Charities, Cohen Opportunity Fund, Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation, Baltimore Community Foundation, and Open Society Institute Baltimore, as well as support from members of the WYPR Board of Directors. I hope you'll join us again on Friday at 9 a.m. on 88.1 FM in the Baltimore region, and everywhere else, streaming live at WYPR.org. Have a great day.